Welcome to the show, The Higher Dimensions. I'm Phyllis Pryser, your hostess. And with us tonight, we have an author and a man about the world, I guess, Jerry E. Smith. He has had a couple of books, one of which we'll talk about tonight, The Secrets of the Holy Land. And he co-authored it with George Picard. I want to make sure that everyone knows that we have a new phone number to call in. So if you want to call in live to this program, it is an 800 number. Let's listen. The new number, 1-877-876-5227. It works worldwide. So check our pages, and we'll find it out on the web pages that's just been posted. But meanwhile, I would like to have my guest come on. Jerry, good evening. How are you?
Well, hi, Phyllis. Good to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, Jerry, I did read your books, as I promised. I always have a way of doing things. I did read the one book, and I've been very busy. And I guess I'm just not interested in the harp area. I have too much else to worry about. But I did appreciate the books that you sent me, and I wanted to let you know that. And I have read, except the last 10 pages, The Secrets of the Holy Lance. And for our readers, number one, I would like you to tell them a little about who you are and where you come from and how you came to write this book with Mr. Picard. Go for it.
All right. Well, I'm a professional freelance writer. My first professional sale was in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what I've written has been ghostwritten, and so I can't. I'm under contract to not tell you about it.
Oh, okay.
Like the last book I wrote was about a nutraceutical, a cure for a disease,
uh-huh.
But it's food. And the problem with when you actually find a foodstuff that cures a disease,
right?
You can't monopolize it. You cannot.
That's true.
You can't get an exclusive on it.
Or a patent or whatever. Yes.
Exactly. And the problem is that the FDA requires that about $300 million be dropped in the research to prove the efficacy.
Yep. Well,
so
okay.
If you're going to make a claim, you got to have big bucks, and you got to be able to
prove what it has to say. Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, a lot rides on that, and you know, there's so many charlatans out there. And scam artists. All you have to look at some of the TV shows that this fat and that thing does this for that, and you come to find out it's not true. For example, a friend of mine was wanting to lose weight, so she answered one of these ads:
mm-hmm.
"Send your $19.95, and we guarantee you to lose 10 pounds." Do you know what they sent her in the mail?
Haven't a clue.
Yes, 2 1-pound bags of Epsom salts.
That's a good one. I worked with this company for most
uh-huh.
of a year, and went over their research. And while I'm not a biologist by any means,
right.
the evidence was extremely compelling that
mm-hmm.
that this product did indeed have an extreme effect. If
mm-hmm.
not a cure, it was darn close to one.
Right.
But of course, they'd only spent $7 million on bringing the product to market. So they realized that the way to go was to write a book about it.
Right.
You know, you may be familiar with chondroitin.
Chondroitin, yes.
Glucosamine.
Yes, yes. My dogs are taking that, actually. I have my dogs on chondroitin, and it does help them. I will say that they're all old dogs,
uh-huh.
and they their bones and everything else, they're in much better condition than dogs I've had before that didn't have it. So I have to say, yes, I agree.
Okay, well, this product blows doors on that product.
Wow.
But the way glucosamine appeared on the market is somebody wrote a book about it. I think the book was titled The Cure to Arthritis.
Okay.
And while the product, if you go into your health food store and read the label, it won't say that it cures arthritis
exactly.
anywhere on it.
Right.
Because that would be a drug claim, and they would have to
yeah.
have done the $200 or $300 million to get to that.
Right. Right.
Right. But they wrote a book on the subject,
mm-hmm.
and the book put it in the marketplace.
Right.
So that's what I did last. So
oh, okay.
That gives you an idea. Basically, my interest is I write books I take on projects in which I can take on the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I took on the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that mm-hmm. the average man is smart enough and sensible enough
mm-hmm.
to be able to deal with freedom. That we do not need to be controlled.
Usually, you know, although I've met some very strange people.
Oh, I agree. there are a number of people, I would guess 2-3% of the
mm-hmm.
human family believes that we all need to be controlled and that they should be our controllers.
That sounds like an oligarchy, actually,
yeah.
rather than a republic or a democracy.
Exactly.
So that's
what I take on. So,
so you're a crusader, shall we say.
Exactly.
Without the cape.
I'm an activist.
Okay.
I have found how to turn my vocation into an advocation and occasionally a vacation.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, I love being paid to travel and speak at conferences.
That works for me.
In fact, where I am right now, I'm in Kempton, Illinois, preparing to speak at a conference here.
In a few weeks, and we'll discuss that towards the end of the show.
Yeah, that's two weekends from now.
Right. But meanwhile, a little bit besides being a crusader and one who helps to liberate the mind, your background, you've been in the military yourself, I understand.
No. I was an anti-war activist during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
A lot of my friends went. Some of my friends went to Canada.
Yeah.
Me, I just stayed in L.A. and got beat up by the police and
dear.
The Marines.
Well, This is not a fortunate part of our history. I happen to have not been fond of the Vietnam War myself. But, you know, that's a subject for another discussion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what I am interested in is your background and education, and you've told us a little bit about what you're doing, which is writing.
Well,
and
we're interested in also
how you got onto this, the Secrets of the Holy Lance.
Okay.
That's fascinating.
I have been a student of religion my entire life.
I
left Christianity at age 14 and never looked back.
Right.
And I've gone through, I don't know, 8 or 10 religions. I've been ordained in 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a keen interest in the
mm-hmm.
in the other side
mm-hmm.
all my
mm-hmm.
life.
The spiritual aspects, perhaps.
Exactly.
Okay.
Education.
Yes.
When I was of age to go to college, I had already sold 2 books
mm-hmm.
and knew about 40 professional science fiction writers
mm-hmm.
and about a dozen professional editors. And
mm-hmm.
over the course of about a year, I talked to every one of them. Did you go to college? And why did you go to college? And they all answered, all the professional writers except one said, nope, never went to college. All the professional mm-hmm. editors said, yep, I did go to college, and I went there to learn how to write. And I realized, this is not a good sign.
Yeah.
It sounds like college is the last place a writer wants to go because they fill you up with the rules. You know, and many of my favorite writers are not only college grads, but they never succeeded in getting out of college.
Like J.R.R.
Tolkien.
They're what?
Like J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay. Well, I would call them permanent
professor.
Students.
You see? So I really am not that fond of academia.
Okay.
So I decided, okay, obviously, my friends who are pros didn't do it. I
mm-hmm.
guess I don't need to either. And with a few slight regrets on the subject, I've been fairly comfortable with that decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any initials after my name.
Didn't say you had to.
My education has been heuristic, entirely self-taught.
Okay,
and that's one of the best
educations to have.
Exactly. I know I've read somewhere between 10 and 20,000 books.
Well, I'm probably going to be up close to you because I read 5 to 10 books a week myself. So,
yeah.
And I have such a. I went to the bookstore today, and I can't pass a bookstore without reaching into my pocket and taking home a few. So I do have a passion about books. So now you've always had a religion in what we call, I mean, an interest in what we call spirituality. But the Holy Lance, I suppose, even though I was raised a Catholic and I'm still very spiritual and I have a passion for history and a passion for archaeology. You know, I really didn't consider there to be a mystery on the Holy Land. So what brought this up to you, brought this to your consciousness and put you on the radar screen for writing a book about it?
Well, I read Trevor Ravenscroft's book, The Spear of Destiny, when it came out back in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very interested in his take on it all being based on past lives. And I was having a...
What's based on past lives? I'm sorry.
Well, half or better of Spear of Destiny is him trying to work out who Hitler and his coterie were a thousand years earlier. It's all about they were the characters, they were the real-life people that the characters in the opera Parsifal are based on.
Okay,
and
I know the opera, right.
And so Trevor Ravenscroft, you know, he was an initiate into an occult order, and he talks about his initiation, he talks about Hitler's initiation, and by extension, the reader's initiation.
Mm-hmm.
The book in some ways may well be a covert initiation into the occult. I know I know a number of people that it affected that way. Well, I read it, was interested, but you know, went on to other things, and it turns out that my publisher, David Hector Childress, here at Adventures Unlimited Press, was selling a number of books on the Spear of Destiny, particularly Colonel Buchner's two books, and Trevor Ravenscroft's book, and the follow-up book that supposedly is written by Trevor Ravenscroft, but is really written by Tim Martin Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
He was my publisher was in something of a quandary in that he did not publish those books. He was merely reselling them and only making pennies per copy.
Well, yeah.
And he thought, you know, if I had one of my own, I could sell them and make dollars per copy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working on the book I'm currently working on now, which is Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
This time, I guess it was, this time last year. And he called me up and said, hey, look, I got a situation here. Can you write me a book on the Spear of Destiny?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Yeah, that would be a fun topic to tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, great, I need it in 2 months.
Ha!
Yeah, and I about passed out. I guess the call came in September last year, and he wanted it by Thanksgiving. I'm fast, but I'm not that fast. So
okay.
My best friend is George Picard, who wrote Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, the CIA, Area 51, and UFOs,
which
was largely about the aftermath of World War II, particularly of Operation Paperclip, which brought Nazi spy masters and rocket scientists to the U.S., how they then used us like a petri dish to culture themselves and turn the Third Reich into the Fourth Reich.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggested to George that we split the book. Since he'd already written a great deal about the Nazis, he'd take the Nazi side of the story, and I'd take the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much how it fell out.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote most of the ancient history stuff, and I wrote the wild Antarctic stuff, and George wrote the Nazi stuff. And then we had a funny way of working. You may have noticed from this conversation, I'm a bit windy. And so the way it worked is George...
like you're alone in the universe, right?
George wrote his chapters and passed them over to me, and I added to them. I wrote my chapters, passed them over to George, and he subtracted from them.
Oh, I see.
I
have conversations with people like that.
I really got into the story of Constantine and the Spear, and I wrote about 100 pages on Constantine, of which I think he cut 30.
Oh, I see. Okay. And why was he so down on poor old Constantine, who, by the way,
I tend to go off chasing butterflies. There were some aspects of the Constantine story that I thought were just as hilarious. That were just amazing stuff. The politics of the fourth century was just insane.
It was. Well, it was very much for grabbing power and expanding it, which, by the way, surprisingly enough, is what we have today. It always has been about that. But
exactly.
Other than that, I guess most people don't know about this. Now, again, the spear that pierced the Christ's side apparently has throughout history been something of a subject of for research and a desire to own. And the story basically, or the book basically, talks about how it was first made. And how did you find out about it? I mean, where did you have to go to get all this information? I imagine you had to do a lot of research.
We did, and trying to do a year's worth of research in a couple of months
to
make the publisher happy was a heck of a challenge.
Well, yeah.
Luckily for me, what I was looking for, I basically knew where it was and found it in great quantity, so I didn't have a big problem with it.
Okay.
Oddly enough, the ancient history stuff is real easy to find on the Internet,
okay.
But it's in odd and surprising places.
Such as?
Well, for almost all of the Roman stuff, I found on websites dealing with Roman coins.
What?
Each coin has its own story, its own history. You know, its own moment in time when it was minted to say something.
To the greater glory and the story of whoever happened to be in ruling at the time. Often.
Exactly. So there are all these Roman coins that have each one individually a page that tells how that coin happened. So
mm-hmm.
you can piece together the history of the Roman Empire one page at a time.
Oh, that's tedious. I'll tell you that.
It was kind of like trying to piece together American history by reading the one paragraph of factotum on the back side of a sugar packet.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it was a fun and frustrating bit. And then the Antarctic stuff, oddly enough, was pretty much the same story. Yeah, I found it on philatelist, on stamp collector websites.
Let's educate the people. Why are we talking about Antarctica? Here we are talking about the swords that pierced Christ's side. Now we're talking about Antarctica. Tell them how it kind of pieces together. You can do it in 250 words or less.
I'm sure I can. The story begins more or less with the crucifixion, and the story is given in the Gospel of John.
Mm-hmm.
That after Christ had died, soldiers were coming to break the bones, and a centurion stepped forward to stop them and pierced Christ's side to prove that he was already dead, so
exactly.
He didn't have to have his body
broken, right.
Exactly. So this then fulfills a prophecy of Zechariah and so forth.
Right.
Okay, now then there are several stories as to, there are several objects in the world today that are claimed to be the spear of the centurion, and that's because there are several different stories as to where the centurion went after the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
There is one in the Vatican. There is one in a church in Armenia. There's one in a museum in Vienna. There's
mm-hmm.
another in a museum in Krakow, Poland, and
mm-hmm.
there's one hidden somewhere in Europe. And
they can't all have been the same lance, I can tell you.
No, they can't all have been. In fact, I'm reasonably certain none of them are.
Right.
But I don't come out and say that in the book.
Right, right.
For a number of reasons. One if we were to say there never was a Jesus, this whole thing is nonsense, I mean, that's the end of the book. You know, the book is one sentence long, maybe two.
Right.
You know, so what we do is we tell the story of the legend of the lance. And the legend of the lance is long and complex and winding and crisscrosses and goes in some very strange places. So we then, what we piece together all the bits and pieces of the legend of the lance, and then we juxtapose the pieces against the backdrop of known history. And we can say, okay, this object appeared here and was used by these people and was believed to do this.
Right,
and then it's up to the reader to decide what
whether or
piece
not.
Of the legend matches their idea of reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the Antarctic story is the wildest piece of the lot, and this is based on this is a branching of one line of the of the legend.
I guess there are several lines of the legend.
Right. Let me give a couple of them in real brief.
Exactly.
I'm in the World Explorers. I'm in the Adventures Unlimited Press bookstore, and the phone is ringing.
Uh-huh.
And I have a child trying to come in the front door, so it's kind of exciting here. Okay. One of the stories is that the lance was that Longinus did not leave the Holy Land. That he stayed.
Longinus is the
Roman centurion.
Okay.
The story goes that the when he pierced the side of Christ, blood and water came out,
right. And
that cured him of blindness, and he instantly became, or not blindness, but a cataract, of incipient blindness, and he then became a convert to Christianity, stayed in the Holy Land, and was martyred in the Holy Land.
Okay.
And his fear remained there and was on display up until about 600. Around 500, the tip of it got broken off, and the tip was given to King Baldwin, who took it back to what is today France, and it was on display in France up till the French Revolution when it vanished.
Mm-hmm.
The body of it was seen in Jerusalem up until it was overrun by the Muslims, and then it disappears for close to 1,000 years and
mm-hmm.
turns up in the 1400s.
Or it's purported to have turned up in the
1400s. Exactly.
So we don't know if it was not. It could have been, like many of the relics were stated to be this, that, and the other thing, and they were not, indeed, this,
exactly.
that, or the other thing. Okay, gotcha.
So what we know of that one
mm-hmm.
is that the way it turned up is the caliph who ruled all of Islam died and left two sons and no clear successor. And the sons warred with each other over who was going to be the ruler of Islam.
Right.
And, of course, one won and one lost. And the
mm-hmm.
loser bugged out and went over to the Christians. And he went to the Knights Templars. And the other name for the Templar Knights is the Hospitaller Knights of St.
Right.
John.
Right.
Since they are the Hospitaller Knights, they gave him hospitality.
Right.
And they quickly realized that he was way too hot to handle, and they packed him off to Vatican and gave him to the Pope. At which point the winning brother goes, oh my gosh, this guy could spill some big beans. I don't want that to happen. And offered to buy his brother from the Pope.
Now, how did you get this information?
This is fairly well-established history. Much of this piece of the storyline comes from the Catholic Encyclopedia.
Oh, okay.
And the Catholic Encyclopedia is not copyrighted, and it's on the internet.
Okay.
So the Catholic Encyclopedia tells us
mm-hmm.
that the Pope accepted the caliph's offer and sold the losing brother for an immense ransom, one of the largest ransoms ever paid by one human for another.
Wow.
And the caliph threw in the whole the Spear of Destiny, the Holy Lance, just to sweeten the pot.
So it
comes to the Vatican, and then over the next couple of hundred years, folks in the Vatican argue about whether it is the real deal or not. And finally, the Vatican officials get tired of all the arguing,
mm-hmm.
and they have built a throne for the Pope, and the throne has a decorative roof, and the roof is supported by four pillars.
Right.
And they take the spear and they wall it up inside one of the pillars.
Good Lord!
Yeah, so it's been there for a couple hundred years now, it's probably not going to come out anytime soon.
Right.
And the Catholic Church officially says, yes, we have it. No, we do not make any claims about it. And so I assume if it was the real deal, they'd be saying, yeah, we got it. So it probably isn't.
Well, that'd be very hard to prove, wouldn't it?
Right. And then the main line of the legend, which is what most people know, and what is the reason most people know it, is because Trevor Ravenscroft wrote about it in his book Spear of Destiny, which became a huge multi-million bestseller and fixed his version of the tale in people's minds. We fill out a lot. He picks up a couple of pieces and leaves the rest of it. He focuses on the Nazis. And so we had to do a lot of piecing together to get what happened before the Nazis. And when we started writing, George and I each decided to start with writing our own. We both wrote chapter one. We each wrote our own draft of the crucifixion.
Yeah.
And I like George's better. And so I said, George, you go with yours. So he writes the crucifixion, and he gets into the story that Joseph of Arimathea and the centurion were friends, and that they traveled together to England. Joseph found Gastonbury Chapel.
Right.
And the spear passes to Queen Boadicea, who leads an uprising against the Romans.
Queen Boadicea. For those who don't know, she was. Go ahead and explain who she was.
Queen Boadicea is
Saxon.
A Celtic queen who may have been of Roman descent. She was very pro-Roman, and she and her husband, dealt with the Romans and were happy to be part of the Roman Empire until he died. And then the Romans decided that they couldn't permit a queen, and they put somebody of their own choosing in charge of her country, which really pissed her off. Protestations ended up with her daughters being publicly raped in the town square.
In front of her yes, as I understand it.
Pardon?
In front of her.
Right. Well, the whole deal was it had to be very public, because the purpose of raping them was to make them less desirable to other nobles, so nobody would ever marry them. And to publicly humiliate her and put her in her place, she was flogged.
Mm-hmm.
This had quite the opposite effect.
Yes.
If you go looking on the internet, you will find every image of her is her holding the spear.
Exactly. She became a warrior queen.
Exactly. And she laid down one of the major pieces of the spear legend in that she was invincible. Whenever she had the spear and met the Romans in battle, she won hands down. She killed at least 25,000 Romans.
Right. They were a very, very, very fierce tribal group of people. They were very good warriors, and they fought, as I understand it, they fought pretty much the way the Americans did during the Revolutionary War, is they, you know, didn't lay them out in battlefields like the Romans did in later on, most formal fights were fought. But they hit them from the trees and from all over the place, which is what we call, what is that warfare?
Guerrilla warfare.
Guerrilla, yeah.
Exactly.
And so, they knew the terrain.
So she won up until they caught her sleeping. Literally, she was taken in the night, separated from the spear. She and her daughters commit suicide rather than be... And then the spear disappears for a while, and it's lost for a couple of hundred years, and it turns up in very unusual hands. It turns up in the gentleman who becomes the first black man to be canonized as a saint, Saint Maurice. And Saint Maurice was the leader of a legion of Roman soldiers. And this legion was known as the Theban Legion because they came from the ancient Egyptian city of
Thebes.
Right. And they were all Christians.
Okay.
And there was an uprising in Gaul, and they might have been Christians who were doing the uprising. And the Caesar the politics at this time is really complex.
Oh yes.
And there's no time in this conversation to even begin to explain. But it was two emperors of the empire at that point.
Right, exactly.
And there soon become four, and then be seven.
Yes.
And at
I
one
know,
point
there
was up
all
to
over
eight.
The place. Yes.
Yeah. Saint Maurice has the spear. He's only Maurice, the leader of the legion. His legion is called to Gaul to help put down this revolt, possibly of Christians, and they're told they have to kill everybody.
Right.
And they're told that they have to engage in this celebration to get the gods on their side.
Right.
And as part of this celebration, they will name Caesar God.
Yeah.
And they say, no, we can't do that.
Can't do it, right. Mm-hmm.
And St. Marie shows them the spear and uses it to remind them that they are Christians and what their vows are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they send a note to Caesar saying, you know, that you're the boss and we'll do what you like, but we're not going to name you God.
Mm-hmm.
And Caesar got really mad.
Caesar's had a tendency to get overly egotistical, shall we say.
This guy had severe personality issues.
He had issues.
Yeah. A brute and tyrant are some of the nicer things you can say about him.
Well, yeah, he was pretty much, yes.
He and his son both play major parts, and you know, the Romans, they keep coming up with these names that are just slightly different from their from each other.
Right.
So it's like Maxentius and Maximinus.
Right.
Maxentius is the father, Maximinus is the son.
Which means, as I was
writing it, I just thought of them as Max and Mini-Max.
Yeah, well, that's just as good as any, to be honest with you.
So Maxentius orders a decimation. Now, we know this word, to decimate, but most people don't realize that it means to kill one in ten.
Every one in ten, yes.
And so he ordered that the legion decimate itself, that they draw lots and one in ten die. For the unruly disorder of the legion,
right.
and they joyously accepted,
mm-hmm.
and went to Christian martyrdom,
mm-hmm.
and then sent back to Caesar. Okay, we've done it, and we're still not going to name you God. At which point Maxentius really gets ticked off and orders a second decimation,
right.
And again they joyously accept martyrdom.
Mm-hmm.
And sending back, okay, we've done it, and we're still not going to name you God.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, Maxentius orders the entire Theban legion wiped out, 6,660
right.
men.
Right.
Now,
isn't this probably where Peter the Great got his idea when he heard that there was a plot while he was visiting France to punish his guard by ordering the death of every tenth person in his personal guard?
I don't really know the answer to that question.
I do
know that decimation has been used throughout history.
Right.
During the German occupation of Europe, the SS regularly decimated villages as a reprisal for partisan attacks.
Right, right. That's true. And we forget about that, don't we?
Yeah.
I know that Peter the Great came back and did that, and Catherine the Great did the same thing, I think. She ordered one out of every ten guards killed. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It looks to us, from best we could piece these things together, we're trying to figure out how it is that Constantine the Great ends up with the Spear of Destiny.
Exactly.
And it looks to us like after the Theban Legion was slaughtered, the spear was given to Maxentius as a trophy. Maxentius then, 25, 30 years later, gives it to Constantine as a wedding present, because Constantine marries Maxentius' youngest daughter, Fausta, which is politically very savvy, but in our society would be rather odd, because his father was married to Maxentius' oldest daughter, Theodora, making father and son brothers-in-law.
Right, it's sort of called incest in our world, but that's okay.
Right. Also, when Mini-Max tries to over Rome and claims I'm the emperor.
Right.
Then we have the battle of the brother-in-laws.
Right.
Now,
aren't we glad we don't live now in those times?
the importance of Constantine is that he has major metaphysical events with the spear. He sees the sign in the sky and hears a voice tell him, with this sign you will conquer.
Mm-hmm.
That's clairvoyance and clairaudience.
Right.
He does indeed see the sign, and he orders his troops to wear the sign they do and win the battle, taking out Max, taking control of Rome. And then a few months later, the Spear talks to him and tells him Rome isn't the place he should have his capital, and tells him to move to this odd little Greek town, Byzantium. And it becomes the capital of the Byzantine Empire, which lasts another 1,400 years.
And it's still sitting there at the Baltic.
Yes.
And the crossroads of the east.
Exactly. Constantine named it Nova Roma, New Rome, which after his death, the citizens renamed Constantinople, which was Constantinople until it was overrun by the Persians and changed its name to Istanbul.
Right.
So it doesn't end there. Constantine fights many battles, and he's invincible in all the battles with the spear, or very nearly all the battles. And there were some odd things that came up. Repeatedly there was big wind. The first day of the battle would go bad, and the next day of the battle would be a huge wind that would destroy the enemy. Constantine wiped out an enemy fleet with this big wind. Two or three people down the road from him, King Theodosius, loses the first day of the battle, rides in with the spear, shouting, "Where is the god of Theodosius? Where is the god of this spear?" And a wind comes up, and the chronologer of the battle said that the wind was so strong it blew the enemy's swords back into their faces. We're running out of time, and we were nowhere near the Antarctic.
This is so fascinating. Part of it that I would like to point out is, even with relics, people have a tendency to become barbaric and to use them for selfish and self-indulgent purposes, which is not a spiritual aspect. But that's just my comment. But people, it seems throughout history that people have, when they've taken this, gotten hold of this purported spear, or so the story goes, they win, but they use it to destroy. They don't use it to build, but to gain for selfish aggrandizement, I guess I should say.
Right.
Selfishness. And I find that very interesting because in the Antarctic, go ahead, we'll go to the Antarctic. I just wanted to throw that in there. It's been my observation that when people think they've got power, they tend to abuse the heck out of it. But go ahead.
The spear disappears after Justinian was the last Roman Empire.
Right,
the
emperor.
Last Roman emperor to have a united empire.
Right.
And if you read Catholic literature,
right,
they think he's the greatest thing, one of the greatest of all the Romans. And that's because he shut down the Hellenistic schools. He told everybody, the spear told him that the Bible was the only book anybody needed to read, and closed any school that used any other text. And that gave us the Dark Ages.
Well, that'll do it.
You read the Catholic Bible, and they go, Justinian is wonderful. You read any other historian, oh, man, this guy was as bad as it gets. Not only that, but he had come into being the emperor of the Eastern Empire, and tried to reunite the empire and succeeded. He was the last guy to succeed in reuniting the empire.
Right.
But in doing so, he squanders the wealth of the empire in one, battles in the west, and two, paying off the Persians to shut up and sit down. And in doing so, he kept paying tribute to the Persians not to attack him, so they got filthy rich. So this is one of the reasons why Islam nearly took over Europe a few hundred years later, is they amassed this tremendous wealth by bleeding Justinian to death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the spear disappears. It's gone for another couple of hundred years, and then turns up on Christmas Day, 800 AD, in the hands of the Pope, as he's using it to crown Charlemagne as the first emperor of the Holy Roman
Empire. Roman Emperor, right.
And the spear stays with the Holy Roman Empire for the next 1,000 years. And that's part of why the Third Reich said they were going to last for 1,000 years, because the First Reich, which was the Holy Roman Empire, lasted for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we detail all kinds of crazy things that happened in that period. The most significant of which is that, again, Charlemagne claimed to have mystical experiences with the spear. He claimed precognition. He claimed that the spear showed him battles before they happened, so that he would know how to fight them and so win them. The spear becomes an artifact of the First Reich. It becomes part of the Reich treasure. And over the next 1,000 years, the Reich treasure grows into an immense treasure of many of swords, crowns, the orb, the scepter, you know, the really expensive, crazy stuff that European rulers thought they needed in order to cement their position. And there's a brief period in which it drops out of sight and then is recovered in the 1400s.
Well, and it's purported, because we all really don't know if indeed this was ever.
Right. So what we have is we have solid provenance, a solid chain of custody on the object that is reputed to be in the Vienna Museum. We have solid provenance on it from about 1460 to 1938.
Okay.
We know that it was on display as part of the Reich treasure, first in Prague, and then the spear spoke to the emperor and told him, "I'm not safe here. Send me someplace where I'm safe." And the emperor sent him the spear to Nuremberg, and it was in Nuremberg.
Which emperor are we talking about there?
Sigismund II, I believe.
And that was in what year?
1460, somewhere in there.
Okay. You said the Reich, and people up here in the 1900s, and you're back somewhere. That's why I wanted to clarify.
Yeah, but the First Reich. It is the Reich treasure.
Uh-huh.
And we're currently working on the Fourth Reich, though nobody's willing to admit it. Sigismund sends it to Nuremberg, and it's in Nuremberg for about 400 years. And then Napoleon marches on Nuremberg.
Right.
And the Nurembergers at this point are convinced that if you have this thing, you are invincible. You do have the destiny of mankind in your hands. You have metaphysical powers. You have a direct line to God. And they do not want Napoleon to get this thing.
Yep.
You know, this is the ultimate super weapon of the 18th century.
Right.
So they stash it. They give it to a nobleman who takes it out of country, and then the Holy Roman Empire ceases to exist. And the nobleman goes, "Cool, I don't have to give it back." He then sells it to the Habsburgs, who have been ruling Austria for about 400 years, and it goes into the Habsburg Museum, and the whole Reich treasure ends up in the Habsburg Museum, and it may still be there. The twist of the tale is that during World War II, the Nazi occult bureau, particularly Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Hitler, were absolutely fascinated by, maybe even to the point of being taken over by it. And Himmler, before the war, had a replica of the spear made to do occult workings with.
Okay, we should point out here that when we talk about this, Hitler was considered very superstitious, was he not? And involved in all sorts of strange rites. He believed in magic, if I'm not mistaken.
It's really hard to sort out what Hitler really believed. There have been so many books about Hitler written from so many points of view that the subject is very, very muddied. We believe that he was, in fact, initiated into the black arts and became a black magician.
So this is just one of the stories that's going around that's very hard to verify.
Exactly.
Okay, so just as we know what's going on.
So Hitler is initiated into the black arts. He becomes convinced that with the spear he will control the destiny of mankind. That he's also convinced he had the spear speak to him in 1907 or 1910 when he's in his late teens or early 20s. And he didn't hear words. He got an image. He got a he saw himself in a past life as one of the kings of the Holy Roman Empire, using the spear as his personal talisman of power.
Mm-hmm.
And when he had that vision, mm-hmm. he became obsessed with the spear, and
mm-hmm.
was obsessed apparently for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Himmler had a very similar relationship with the spear. Himmler in 35 has a replica made.
Mm-hmm.
He then finds a castle and has the castle appointed. It has it renovated to where every room in the castle is appointed with objects owned by previous possessors of the spear, accruing all the occult power of all these entities into one spot. And in the basement of this castle,
mm-hmm.
they do black magic rites using this replica of the spear.
Now, is this historically accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And the castle exists today. It has a website.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, this is now one of the weirder tourist traps in Europe.
Okay. Okay.
They have sealed up the chamber where they did the black magic, but the rest of the castle is on display. So
okay.
The story goes that with the Anschluss, which was the annexation, the union of Greater Germany and Austria, Hitler rolled into Austria and claimed the spear as his own,
mm-hmm.
kept it on his person for the next 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the 8 months of Hitler's invincibility. That was the 8 months where the Blitzkrieg rolled across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then a very strange thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
He ordered the spear to be put on display in Nuremberg. Now, the twist of the tale is that Himmler intercepted it. Intercepted it, had a Japanese swordsmaker make an exact replica. The replica went on display in Nuremberg, and the real one
mm-hmm.
stayed in Himmler's crazy castle to do real black magic with. Now, this story gets legs and runs in 1984 when an American college professor
uh-huh.
who taught medicine, he's a doctor, taught medicine at Tulane and LSU. He's written like 240 medical textbooks and also a series of books on art history. He's a very prolific writer.
Mm-hmm.
This is Dr. Howard Buchner.
Okay.
Buchner had been a battalion surgeon during World War II
mm-hmm.
and had witnessed the Dachau massacre, which was when the U.S. Army arrived at Dachau prison. They took all the German guards into custody
right.
and then went in to see what was going on. And what they saw so offended them, they came out and they shot all the Germans, which rather offended Dr. Buchner. Buchner wrote a book about it at the
okay.
beginning of the 80s, and shortly after the book came out, he was approached by a former submariner,
mm-hmm.
a German submariner, who said
okay.
that he had been part of what we now know as the Führer convoy, that there had been at least 2, possibly as many
mm-hmm.
as 12
mm-hmm.
submarines leave Nazi Germany in literally the last hours of the war.
Right.
And that this guy had on board his boat Martin Bormann and his entourage and the Spear of Destiny. That Hitler had taken a young colonel who they gave as a pseudonym for Colonel Maximilian Hartmann. That they say that this Colonel Hartmann was taken aside personally by Adolf, who said, "I have some stuff I don't want anybody to get. You're going to go collect it up. You're going to take it down to the submarine base. You're going to have sealed orders. The captain will open the orders after he's at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much." And Colonel Hartmann collects up these 8 bronze boxes, takes them down to the submarine base at Kiel, which was never taken
mm-hmm.
by the Allies during the war. They only got it after the surrender.
Right.
A number of submarines leave and
right.
go to Argentina, drop
right.
off their VIP passengers in Argentina, and at least one proceeds on to Antarctica, where the crew get out and stash these 8 bronze boxes.
Yeah.
Now, Colonel Hartmann was a member of Himmler's circle of what weird initiates.
Right.
He gets a message, and at the end of the 60s, it's time to reform the circle. And he gets a pile of money and some directions.
Uh-huh.
He reforms Himmler's circle of whacked out knights.
Uh-huh.
And they Himmler had called them the Knights Grand Council. He renames them as Knights of the Holy Lance. And of course, if you're the Knights of the Holy Lance, you have to have the Holy Lance.
Well, that works. Yeah.
And their primary directive, the first thing they have to do is reform a united Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, of course, they need the power of the
mm-hmm.
Lance.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1979, Hartmann gets a hold of some of these submarine crew that had helped take it there,
mm-hmm.
because they know where the heck it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets them to assist in the Hartmann expedition. And
hmm.
our book begins and ends with the Hartmann expedition,
right.
recovering the Holy Lance from Antarctica in 1979 for a couple of reasons. We did as a
mm-hmm.
a literary device,
right.
we begin each chapter with
right.
a dramatization, with a fictionalization of what the most
right.
important scene in the chapter.
Right.
And we decided, well, we should do that with the whole book, too.
Right.
So the book begins with a dramatization, with a fictionalization
uh-huh.
of what it might have been like with Hartmann recovering the spear.
Right, exactly.
And we did this because this, if this is true,
right.
then the spear is not in a church in Armenia, not holed up in the Vatican, it's not on display
uh-huh.
in Vienna. It's an active player
uh-huh.
on the world stage, and it's in the hands
uh-huh.
of black magicians who think
mm-hmm.
they can use the power of God to
mm-hmm.
alter the destiny of mankind.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I'm amazed that we managed to do it in less than an hour.
Well, you know...
But, of course, we left out huge...
A lot of stuff.
We left out several hundred pages.
Well, yeah, but, you know, reading it is different than talking it, and
mm-hmm.
you did a fine job. It was really, that's why I found the book interesting. And, you know, we also had a conversation. Does anybody have any questions about this book? If anybody wants to call in and talk about it or put their 2 cents worth in, please feel free. We don't have too much time left, but we certainly do have a few minutes.
And I want to try and steal a couple of those minutes.
You do have something else you wanted to talk about, and I'm going to do that, but I was going to give people the opportunity to call in as
mm-hmm.
you were listening.
Of course.
Yes, he had mentioned and you about the Ancient Science and Modern Secrets Conference that's going to be taking place May 5th through the 7th in Kempton, Illinois. And you can say a couple words about that, and then we're going to have to kind of, I hope, wrap up the story. But this is just wonderful. Go ahead.
Okay. Kempton is in northern central Illinois. It's about a 2-hour drive south of Chicago's O'Hare Airport.
Uh-huh.
It's about halfway between Chicago and Champaign, and uh-huh. Just about dead center between I-55 and I-57. The conference has 7 speakers. David Hector Childress will be speaking on Atlantis, Mu, and the Power System of the Gods. William Henry on Oracle of the Illuminati. Joseph Farrell on the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, which is his next book about to come out, and Reich of the Black Sun, which is his last book, which dovetails nicely into my book.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to be speaking on the Spear of Destiny and can fill out a bit more and have some pictures and whatnot.
Oh, what fun!
Christopher Dunn is turning Egyptology on its head. Christopher Dunn is an engineer who has spent his entire life working with high-speed machine tools, and
uh-huh.
he went to the Great Pyramid in Egypt, took one look at it, and said, "No, this you cannot build this with stone pounders and copper chisels,"
uh-huh.
and shows definitively that this is the result of high-speed milling, that they had high-tech milling equipment. So that's the topic of his speech. He's going to be evidence for ancient machining. And then there's a fellow who goes by the name of Sesh Harry, and he wrote a novel about Nikola Tesla and Mars called Wonder of the World.
Right. Tesla being a very famous late 20th, early 21st century inventor. Marvelous person.
Probably the greatest genius of his age. We live in a world given to us by him. He discovered, he brought us AC power, alternating current. Our world is run on AC power.
Right.
And of the 46 basic patents in AC power, he holds 45.
Amazing, isn't it?
Was the guy who discovered radio.
Yes.
Marconi pirated it. Marconi was a spy. He went to work for Tesla.
Well, let's not get into that. We're just talking about that. At any rate, I'm so glad that you had the opportunity to come and talk, and I hope you've had fun. My desire is to bring new objects and new subject matters to people and that touch on the spiritual. Now, my feeling is this. I don't really believe that objects carry a life of their own, okay? I think there's a residue left of people's energy, but, and that's true from a psychic standpoint. You can touch something somebody has and get stories from it. Do I believe something is inherently evil or not? An inanimate object? I don't think so. I mean, that's something that perhaps somebody would like to talk about if they wanted to call in and say what their opinion is, if something has evil or not in it. I doubt it. I've never seen it. I've never felt it. I've never known it to be. What people put their imaginations to.
In our book, Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny and History and Legend, we leave it open to the reader to make up their own mind about it. We offer several possibilities.
Right.
I'm not a Christian, as I don't even believe Christ ever existed, I tend to disbelieve that the power of Yahweh is coming through this thing.
On the other hand,
one of the things I realized is that it's been on display virtually continuously for 1,200 years. Mm-hmm. Millions of people a year have looked at this thing. Mm-hmm. Did they invest it with power?
Has power if you give it power.
We're running out of time.
Okay, we got a couple of moments to go. I kind of tend to agree. I think nothing has power unless people provide it from their own energy sources. And I certainly don't think God needs a sphere to do this, that, or the other thing for him. And I don't think that, quite frankly, the good Lord abuses anything that has not but the best for all mankind. But that's my one woman's opinion. I do want to thank you again so very much for giving of your time and your generous time. And again, I have to say that I am Phyllis Pricer, and I am your hostess for The Higher Dimension. It's been a joy and a pleasure to have you as a guest. I appreciate all your words and know that you did a lot of hard work. And I applaud you for it, and I hope that conference goes fantastically well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night from BBS Radio and The Higher Dimension. I'm Phyllis Pricer. Goodbye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.